On the weekend of October 12th, the New York State Writers Institute hosted Telling the Truth in a Post-Truth World, an ambitious multi-event symposium on topics crucial to an open democratic society. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati spoke to one of the participants, Albany Law School professor Anthony Paul Farley, who participated on a heated panel called The First Amendment and Free Speech Under Attack.
I'm Aaron Pettinati, and today I'm interviewing Professor Anthony Paul Farley. Professor Farley is the James Campbell Matthews Professor of Jurisprudence at Albany Law School, where he teaches advanced constitutional law. Professor Farley, I want to thank you for sitting down for the interview today.
Sure, I'm happy to.
So I just witnessed a very interesting panel discussion in which you were a member involving a number of prominent First Amendment absolutists, perhaps most prominently including Floyd Abrams of The Nation magazine. Throughout the discussion, things got a bit heated. I'm wondering if you can unpack for us your sense of what happened there and explain your position on the issues that were discussed.
Well, I think sometimes for liberals, they worry when their views link up to conservatives is exposed or explained.
And on that front, I should add that the discussion involved liberal and conservative First Amendment absolutists.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. So you think that there was a kind of anxiety there about the sort of umbrella that they might have been sitting under?
Well, it's hard for me to say because I was on the panel and I liked my co-panelists and we had that. We're all putting on a panel moment, but it from after the discussion, I heard from members of the audience, and I heard from you that they could see certain tension points between the left position, if I use that for myself, that I was putting forth, and the liberal, conservative, and perhaps brass tacks business model that was put forth by my co-panelists.
So could you maybe summarize some of what those disagreements were about?
Well, I remember a speaker from the audience said that he didn't believe in safe spaces at university campuses and felt that the real people who were excluded from university campuses were conservative thinkers and conservative students. And as I recall, Floyd Abrams agreed with him. Now, my recollection of my co-panelist statements is a little bit is fading now that the panel is done.
Well, I was there, and I can affirm that that seemed to be what was going on.
Okay, well, so, and that agreement might be a little bit startling, right? And that agreement is actually where my own research really begins in looking at those kind of agreements between what purports to be the left, that is the liberal position, and the right, and what it excludes, right, which is a proper left analysis, an analysis that might radically go to the roots of some of our problems. So in talking about hate speech on campus, I said that no one has asked for anything other than the extension of the normal rules of civility to the populations that were hitherto viewed as abnormal and not belonging at universities. Conservatives have a problem figuring out how to do that because they think we shouldn't do it. So they have a problem figuring out conservatives have a problem of figuring out why we should do it. In fact, they say we shouldn't. Liberals have a problem figuring out how we could do that without ruining certain other sacred values they have. Both agree that it would be something special to do this, and I say it wouldn't be anything special. It would just safe spaces just mean treat the populations you have hitherto excluded the way you treat yourselves. You find it hard, and so we might even make some explicit rules to guide you in that behavior. So it's conduct unbecoming of a student on a campus to do all kinds of things. If anything is conduct unbecoming of a student on any campus anywhere, then flying a Confederate flag must be conduct unbecoming of a student. Not just because it represents treason against the United States. I think that probably should be tolerated, at least symbolic treason against the United States. But because that Confederate flag, in addition to representing a dedication to treason against the United States, also indicates a dedication to slavery.
Right, and the same thing could be said for Nazi insignia and other types of symbols of hate speech. So could you maybe put that in the context of your expertise as a constitutional law professor, and also the question of how the United States is so unbelievably tolerant of some of these forms of speech in comparison to other liberal democracies around the world?
Right. Well, first, we're not really a democracy, properly speaking. But second, when we look at doctrines like disorderly conduct, intentional infliction of emotional distress, group defamation, fighting words, and threats, we see that there are some speech acts that have such a low communicative value and so radically disrupt the personality of the target at which they are aimed that we criminalize them. And we've done it for a long time. Intentional infliction of emotional distress has been a tort for a while. Disorderly conduct, everyone recognizes that charge. Group defamation, fighting words, threats, these are all things that the law provides a solution for. What we've done, without being honest about what we have done, is made exceptions within all of those doctrines for racism. If what you're doing is being racist or sexist or homophobic, you often find courts saying that that somehow is magically, therefore, not disorderly conduct, or intentional infliction of emotional distress, or group defamation, or fighting words, or threats. So people can even come up with the... It's almost like a drunkenness produced by racism, where they view something like a burning cross as communicating something that has some sort of First Amendment value and not as a death threat.
Right. And also along those lines, the issue of Charlottesville today, do you feel like when you're in these discussions that the recent ways in which the use of this type of speech in public seems to have almost undeniably involved a certain level of incitement to violence, that it produces a little bit of cognitive dissonance on the part of some of your interlocutors about these issues?
Yes, I think that they, particularly the First Amendment fetishists, are so kind of inebriated, one might say, with these the doctrines that allow these kind of displays to take place, that they can't really interrogate coherently what is in fact taking place. Right? They look and see Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the campus of the University of Virginia with torches, saying, "Jews will not replace us." They actually kill someone. Two more people die as a result of this. What are they fighting for? They're fighting, they say, to not have, I guess, Jews replace them. So there's an anti-Semitic fight, a Nazi element to the fight. And there is a pro-slavery element to the fight, because they are arguing that statues to people who fought to preserve the institution of slavery for the Confederacy should remain in a public square. So this is an astonishing thing to look at as somehow a speech act that should be protected. And I should add, they're marching with torches, and many of them were armed, at least according to the films that I saw, with military-grade weapons.
Yeah, so there you've got issues of public safety as a direct threat or an issue with direct bearing on the transactions that are going on. And what about that issue of incitement to violence when it comes to things that could be flagrantly construed as hate speech?
Well, say that again.
Like, the extent to which liberals and conservatives kind of line up defending forms of public speech that seem to involve a certain level of incitement to violence without necessarily calling into question the extent to which it was incitement to violence.
Yes, it's astonishing. So they will look at something that is an immediate incitement to violence, right? Hey, look, I'm burning this cross, or I'm marching as a Nazi on the campus of the University of Virginia with a bunch of other people who are carrying torches. So that is an incitement to violence in several different ways. First, the crowd is whipping itself up into a frenzy. Like, something is going to happen. The powder keg will ignite. I am a graduate of the University of Virginia. That's where I did my undergraduate degree. The Rotunda, the original part of the university, has burned down before. Not when I was there, but a long time ago. It amazed me to see that racism allowed people to carry torches onto the university campus. If some random person had wandered onto the University of Virginia lawn, our sacred ground there, carrying a torch, that person would have been removed. But this is that exception that is made for racist activities, where race, the fact that it's racist is treated as giving you a special right to ignore the rules that would otherwise apply. So when we were talking about campus safe spaces, for example, my discussion was really focused on, if we do for everyone what we've done for some, we'll be fine. But we're rejecting changing the old rules of, the old rule being only white men are allowed to be comfortable at a university campus. Right? We're maintaining those old rules by pretending we don't know how to extend that protection to everybody else.
So last question. With regard to the issue of addressing this in a way that involves legislation and possibly, social change, what sorts of norms or principles would you suggest?
Oh, say that again. Let me think through that.
The issue of actually addressing this at the level of policy, what would you suggest be adopted with regard to hate speech versus freedom of speech, First Amendment concerns, those types of things?
Well, this is tricky and it's not tricky, right? Universities know what they are doing when they put manuals together to attract students, right? When you look at a university, brochure, right, or application, it all looks like the way we wanted to imagine things in the 1967 Haight-Ashbury, right? Everyone is getting along famously. It's a United Nations of different kind of students and different backgrounds at the university campus. But what things do you need to do as a university to make those pictures in the brochure true? Then those are the things that you need to do. It's not like you don't know them. You know the goal. You know, what do we need to do to make these kind of students comfortable with each other? As a philosophical principle, I guess I was suggesting that conservatives and liberals are disingenuous when they pretend that this is a battle of ideas. Somebody saying that women can't do science or black people can't do whatever it is that they say black people can't do, that person isn't making an argument. They are eliminating somebody else's right to even be in the argument. A debate needs two debaters. The rule for a debate is everybody is an equal participant in the debate. If one side says the other side is really just a monkey, right, or something less than a person, then that debate is actually over. There's no rejoinder to that. The debate is over because the whole point of a debate, as we have said at the beginning, everybody here is equal and will be treated with equal respect. A university is supposed to be a place of debate. That means, first and foremost, everybody has to be treated as an equal, as a person with a right to debate. When hate speech is hate speech because it suggests that someone doesn't have a right to be party to the debate, saying that, women can't do this, blacks can't do this, Jews will not replace us, those are all statements about someone not having a right to be at the debate. They are not statements of a debater.
So some kind of fundamental set of norms with regard to the underlying humanity of everyone involved in the debate needs to be respected in order to foment a situation that's actually legitimate discourse in the first place.
Yes, otherwise we're not having discourse. Otherwise we're just having a war. No one can, if somebody says, you're not a person, you can't respond and say, I am a person in a debate. Because if you respond that way, you have just signaled that your humanity is debatable. And if your humanity is debatable, you're not the same as I am. Humanity is what actually has to be assumed. Humanity has to be beyond debate for us to have a debate.
Right. Well, thank you very much for this interview and also for your role in the panel discussion today. It was fascinating, and I really enjoyed everything that you had to say.
Thank you very much.
That was WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati speaking with Albany Law School professor Anthony Paul Farley.